This is a replay of the Wednesday night, April 22nd, WGN show. We started right at 10. If you don't hear yourself on it, it's because you didn't call, and I hope you'll rectify that soon. We're live Monday through Thursday evenings from 10 to 1 Central. Dial 888-876-5593. My toll-free number from OneVoip. For the world's best customer service, it's OneVoip. Check them out at the number 1-VOIP.com. You'll be really glad you did.
Direct from the edge of the lunatic fringe, it's the Raleigh James Show.
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James. We have 3 hours to spend together, but the first hour I'm spending with Del Stecker. Now, I'll share them if you want, so 888-876-5593 if you want to get in on this. Otherwise, sit back and listen because you are about to learn things that you never knew existed. Yeah, I've got a few of them in mind. Del Stecker, welcome to WGN Radio.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be here.
I'm delighted, and I loved Colored Pebbles, which is the latest and greatest, and I put a link on Raleigh.net. I found it on Amazon, so it is now available to the general public, and that is terrific. I haven't counted, but I would assume there's probably at least 36 different characters in this.
Well, I think I lost count. You know, it took 75 years in the making.
Yes, exactly. And there are so many things I want to ask you, but one of the shortest, absolutely one of the shortest, is also, as you term it, the darkest pebble. So I hate to give this away because I hope people will go out and buy this. However, we're talking here about Ted Bundy. But tell me about your reaction to meeting him.
Well, it was just unplanned. It happened as it turned out, in the height of the time when he was killing people, but no one knew at the time. I was going to graduate school at the University of Puget Sound, and his mother was a secretary in the graduate department, and I was there getting ready to talk to one of my professors. The secretary introduced this lady, and then right then her son walked in and she introduced me to her son, and I shook hands with him. He was very pleasant and personable, as we later found out that was part of his modus operandi. But when I looked at him, he scared the death out of me. His eyes were just the most evil thing, and it just affected me. And I went home that afternoon and I got very drunk. So that's what happened.
What did you think when you found out about his nefarious deeds?
I felt like I had dodged the bullet, even though he didn't go after males. You know, my path in life had crossed his, even for that brief moment. But immediately, when it came up who and what he was, and I recalled that meeting, immediately, even today, I go back to looking down into his eyes. And he's very, very evil, dark. So it affected me. And you say, it's, you know, with all my colored pebbles, all the good things in my life, and all these wonderful people I wanted to thank for making me who I am, he's the one and only dark pebble that I wrote about. It happened over 50 years ago, and it scared the heck out of me that day. And it still troubles me when I think about it.
You know, it's interesting because there's almost a subtext here where I would think at the time when you found out exactly who he was, there was a certain amount of vindication for your gut feelings. One of those, I knew it feelings. You had to have had that to a degree.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Up until that time, you know, that occurrence, that day, it was, you know, you kind of push it off. You know, you met somebody really terrible, it affected you. You know, I had a bad afternoon and evening, hangover the next day. And then I put it out of my mind. And then a couple years later, because his real killing spree was from 74 to 78, and I think his name came up somewhere around 78, 79, and right in there. And then, I felt vindicated in a strange, weird way.
Yeah, I would think also that it's probably not an isolated example in terms of you having, I won't say premonitions, but maybe just feelings that are not necessarily quantifiable or verifiable about all sorts of things. And I think that sort of runs through your book, not anywhere near like The Darkest Pebble here, but nonetheless, you have a certain amount of, how shall we say, psychic ability. Did you know that?
If I characterize it, going back, I have a great memory, and I explained in the book, as a kid, I read encyclopedias. I've got a decent IQ. I love trivia, and I'm what I would recall myself. I'd call myself an ISBE kind of person. I like being in the moment. I like observing what I'm in. And I think that gives me a heightened awareness. I don't know if it's any kind of a psychic ability or anything. Maybe it's just a natural talent. But I'm really focused, and I remember who I met, you know, the people that affect me. And there are times when I'm in a moment and I'm kind of step outside of myself and I realize that I'm in it and I'm also observing it. So,
well,
and that's why... That's why I think I wrote what I wrote.
And I can understand. It is just great. And there are so many people I want to ask about. But, of course, you know I'm going to focus on the Birdman of Chicago because I got a lot of questions here. So we're talking to Del Stecher. The book is Colored Pebbles, and it is available right now all over the place, including at Amazon. There's a link at Rolly.net, R-O-L-L-Y-E.net. So pick it up. And if you want to join us, by all means, 8888 R-O-L-L-Y-E. All right. But before we get back to it, I want to mention the CC Radio 3. Love talking about the Sea Crane Company, because their radios are just better. And when I say that, it was many years ago that Bob Crane was as disgusted as some of us were with the lousy reception that radios that were being made in the 80s and things like that just had the 80s and 90s. I mean, you know, they'd have all these bells and whistles, but then you couldn't pick up anything. And he said, I can do better. And boy, did he. The one commonality that everything in the Sea Crane catalog has is it has just terrific AM and FM reception. And that's really true about the CC Radio 3, the almost everything radio. I say that because it has the addition of Bluetooth, and the speaker is so nice that John actually uses it as a Bluetooth speaker. So you can use it for that purpose alone. It's also got the 2-meter ham band. So that may give you information in emergency you're not hearing anywhere else, certainly not on your smartphone. But even day-to-day, fun to hear the hams jawing back and forth. But and of course, I should say, all the bells and whistles, you know, the clock and the alarm and the presets and the timer and the weather band and the weather alert, of course. But if you are frustrated by what you're not picking up well on any other radio, the CC Radio 3 will leave it in the dust. Go to ccradio.com, look at the CC Radio 3. If you can't do that, you can call them. Great customer service, 800-522-8863. 800-522-2, and they'll answer all your questions, and you can order by phone. But if you can go online, not only great products, but great information about radio as well. It's a real repository, ccradio.com. You look at the CC Radio 3, I think you're going to like it. You tell them Rolly sent you from WGN Radio.
Easy and always pretend that you're cool, so cool,
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James. Now, often I'll ask, well, what inspired you to request that song? But I think I know Johnny Cougar in 1982 on Riva, a hand to hold on to. And we're talking to Del Sticker, who has written a number of things, but Colored Pebbles is the latest. And yeah, good choice, because I think it does really epitomize what you're saying in the book, Del. So I got to ask you, as we talk about the Birdman of Chicago, do you still have the miniature camel?
No, it was lost in a divorce.
Oh no! Yeah. No, I'm sure you fought hard for it.
That was one of the most treasured things I had, because it was given to me when I was about 7 years old, and it was cut out of a palm tree that was over 2,000 years old, and my uncle Erling, the Birdman, got the camel from his Aunt Esther, who was also mentioned in the book.
Yeah.
It's long gone.
Now, how could you have lost that? I can't imagine any court awarding that camel to anyone. This was your birthday gift as a child.
Well, I don't want to go back into the divorce, but my ex never gave me many things that belonged to me.
Oh.
And I've long since gotten over it.
Yeah. I can see that. You've got it in your memory forever.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, possessions really mean nothing to me right now. I have memories. You know, that's what the book is all about. You know, I've been blessed to be in great situations with many special people, and I describe, a good number of them. And a lot of them are listening tonight. The ones that I want to give a shout out to, Vic and Frank and Harold and Gabby, my son Trad. I do believe that the Zulu phrase that I am because we are, that's what I wanted to tell people in this book, because it took 75 years of living. As we talked the last time I was on the show, I was commanded to tend to my writing, and this is the writing that I tended to. So it's my life laid out for people, and I hope that people enjoy it.
Oh, I'm sure they will, because it's compelling on so many levels. So I mentioned the camel, of course, and this is in the same chapter with a King Tut's totem. So you got to tell me about that.
Well, out of the blue, my Uncle Erling, the Birdman, he calls me, and he just goes into conversation about his problems and things, and he brings up that he's being followed by the representatives from the Egyptian government, federal agents, and it's about a totem that his aunt, you know, Aunt Esther, got it from Lord Carnarvon and the archaeologist Carter. You know, when they opened King Tut's tomb, there were all these little things that were down there, little totems, and the thing was about maybe 13 inches high. And he misplaced it. And, you know, he was getting on in years, and he called me and wanted to know, did I have a hiding place in his apartment and studio? And I couldn't fathom what he was talking about. It was a totem from King Tut's tomb, which he had all his time in his life. And I understood when he died, no one found it. So it could be hidden in the building or it was lost. I don't know. But it's never shown up.
And that's fascinating because, of course, there are so many stories about anybody who had any interaction with anything from King Tut or his tomb. All manner of hell descended on them. So while the State Department might have been following him and the entire Egyptian government, seems like he came out unscathed.
Yeah. He was such a marvelous character. You know, Old Town in the 50s and 60s in Chicago was the Greenwich Village of the Midwest. And it was just a great place to be, and there was just no way to describe being around him in and out of his shop, and it was just magic. And for him to be my godfather and uncle, and all through my life, somebody who would just come in and out, and he was also, when I was growing up, a refuge. I could get on the train, go downtown, and hop a bus, and go hang with him for a little bit. And the funny thing is, I never really liked birds. He's famous ornithologist, and birds opened so much into his life and all, and he was wonderful for me and all. But I just never really got into all the bird things. It was him that I really cared about.
Understandable, but some of these birds, my God, that $20,000 macaw, you're talking about serious birds here.
Oh, yeah, and he was famous for being able to take exotic birds and have them mate and reproduce in captivity. He was one of the first to do that, and he was all self-taught. You know, he was not educated in any way formally to be an ornithologist, but he became well-known throughout the world as an expert on exotic birds. And he had very many international people would fly to Chicago to come to his shop. And I remember one in particular was Tallulah Bankhead, the actress. She came in the 50s. And you know, people like that would come in and, you know, they, back then, and, you know, dropping $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 on a bird. And also that he loved to do the handmade cages.
I can't even imagine. So, and he's mating them right there on North Sedgwick in Old Town, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
You normally wouldn't expect that. But what's there today at 1728 North Sedgwick?
It's some kind of an office building now. Sometime about 10 years ago, I tried to get in touch with the owners, and I think I sent them when I wrote another Southside, the book.
Yeah.
I use 1728 North Sedgwick as an address, and it's written into one of the stories. And I think I sent him a copy, and I just mentioned it to him. But you can Google it and see from the street. I think it's some kind of a business is there now.
They have no idea about the ground they're standing on, I am sure. And you will when you read Colored Pebbles. It is a wonderful book, and just one of many. We have Dell on every time he writes a new book, and I hope there's another one coming soon. We'll talk about that. But in the meantime, this is just out. So Colored Pebbles, you can go to Amazon or anywhere else and pick up a copy. If you got any questions or comments, absolutely, I won't hog Dell. But if you don't, well, yes, I will. So we'll pick it up after the news right here on WGN Radio.
When I woke up this morning, you were on my mind, and you were on my mind. I got trouble, so I got worry, so I got just to ease my pain, just to ease my pain. I got trouble, I got worried, oh, I came home again. But I woke up this morning, you were on my
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James. The Wee Five, You Were On My Mind, A&M, 1965. Height of the British invasion. A lot of people thought that was true for the Wee Five, too, and it wasn't. They were an American folk rock group. They were actually from the Bay Area. And You Were On My Mind was originally done by Ian and Sylvia. Didn't hit. And so here come Wee Five. It becomes their biggest hit, and you're saying, whatever happened to them? Well, they didn't last very long. I think they were together about 2 years. And then they'd come back occasionally and do a studio album. But it was Del Stecker's choice, and happy to play it. Now, as I mentioned, it was obvious to me why the Johnny Cougar choice, but Del, got to ask, what brought you to Wee Five?
Well, I just always liked that song, but the lyric, you know, it's You Were On My Mind, and all these people that I wrote about have been on my mind, and you know, I get these thoughts, they come in, they go out, and it just happened I sat down and wrote about each one of them, and I truly, they're on my mind, and I don't know. It's just a great song, too. It's a happy song in a way. So,
Well, you bring every one of these characters to life, even the ones we've never heard of. We feel like they're friends after we read your accounts. And, of course, the ones we have heard of, some might surprise us, and others, well, I'm not at all surprised. For instance, Eddie Arnold calling your mother sounds like something he would do. So tell me about that.
Well, you know, it was part of my job to meet with him because I was working on the Country Music Hall of Fame. And, of course, he was a member at the time, and he was known as a crusty old guy, and tight with his money. And I went down to see him, and as I tell him the story, it didn't go well at first. I just, you know, my ability to see articles in someone's office, bring up conversation, and, you know, make that connection, it just didn't work. And just when I was leaving, I happened to see the picture of his boat on the wall, and I remembered that he was a friend of a boater, another person that I wrote about, Frank Swigert. And I said, oh, gee, before I leave, I got to mention that Frank says hello. And next thing I know, Eddie Arnold became like a whole different human being. And later on, I found out from many people that he was very warm and wonderful and personal and such a good friend to people and bent over backwards for people and all. But spending time with him, and then in the end, you know, we spent the whole day. We have lunch. He agrees to give a whole bunch of money to the Hall of Fame. And then again, just by leaving, he picks up the phone and says, "What's your mother's phone number?" You know, because in the conversation, I mentioned that she was a big fan. And the next thing you know, he's on the phone with her, and I'm ushered out. Like you said, the story goes on. And he and my mom were good friends for a while. He's trading notes and on the phone and everything.
That's great.
And that's, yeah. Today a lot of people don't remember him. But, you know, back in the 60s and early 70s, he was, you know, as big could be in entertainment, you know. And I remember being a kid watching him on Ed Sullivan and all his shows and everything. And then to be there with him and meet him and talk to him, that was wonderful. But then how the human side of them came out. And that's what I wanted to do with each one of these people. Some of them are famous. Some of them are just people in my life that are so meaningful, you know.
Yeah, it's a great, great story. And everything I knew about him, I remember talking to him once after he'd been on the charts for something like six different decades. And, you know, I said, what do you attribute it to? He said, I treat it like a business. I come into my office every day. I answer my mail. I pay my bills. And it is my business. And I thought that was very well put, to say the least. And it was kind of the epitome. He was just a nice guy all the way around. And I'm glad that it worked out, because I'm not surprised that he donated. Now, another deal, you know, you mentioned him on the phone with your mom, who I know initially didn't believe it was him, right? Says, is this really?
Yeah,
but worked out well. But another call, which is fascinating, because I also want to get to what precipitated it, but tell me about Ross Perot.
Oh, golly, that was, you know, that was just wonderful, because when I wrote the book, the World War II history book, which was about my dad's time, 5 years in the Navy on this very fantastic ship, I wrote the book and got some good notice on it and things. And I remembered I had interviewed, when I was getting out of the Army, Ross Perot's company interviewed a lot of junior officers for jobs. And I was offered a job, and I turned it down, and I did something else. And then later on in life, I was interviewing for a job in fundraising for the medical center, and he was on the search committee. And I was the dark horse candidate, but they determined I was too young at the time. But so I didn't get the job. So when I wrote the book, and knowing that he was a big military supporter, a Navy man, I just sent him a copy of the book and said, you know, I almost worked for you twice, but, you know, I just thought you might like this book. And then out of the blue, his secretary arranged to fool me with my wife setting me up. And I just answered the phone, and it's him. You know, it was no prep, no call, no nothing. And, you know, there I am. I'm talking to Ross Perot. And he had that very distinct, high-pitched kind of voice. But it was so funny, because he said, you know, this is Ross Perot. And he spells his name, you know, E-E-R-O. you know, and I'm like, of course I know who you are, you know, Mr. Perot, Mr. Perot. And he's telling me, no, it's not Mr. Perot, it's Ross, R-O-S-S, Ross, you know, Dell, you know. And we chatted on the phone. It was really great. And he, you know, we're talking about the book. And he was just, you know, giving his personal time to me just because I sent him a book. I've gotten notes back from people or things and saying, oh, thanks for the book or whatever. Or I've sent it and you never hear anything from anybody. But it was really, really good. So we're talking on the phone. And then in the end, he wraps it up and says, yeah, is there anything I can do for you? You know, so we can buy a couple hundred books and, you know, and give. And he goes, yeah, that's really funny. You know, it was just so good, you know. And later on, I there was a follow-up book that was related to it, and I sent him that, too, with another letter. And he didn't call me. He wrote me a very nice personal note. It was just, you know, out of the blue. And here's a guy that, you know, back in the 90s, he could have been president. He sure changed the world.
Yeah.
But he was so personal, and to take out time for that, he was, again, just like Eddie Arnold, a real human being, I was looking at, you know, who am I? You know, it's, you know, this great man calls me and spends the time. And it wasn't one of those in and out phone calls. He actually shared time with me on the phone and conversed. And, you know, he could have just said, thanks a lot, you know, moved on and blown me off. But it was really an experience. It always affected me. So
that's great. Absolutely great.
As I explained, some of these people in the book are, they've been with me a long time, affected me, and others are kind of like hit and miss, a one-off kind of experience, but they really stayed with me. You know, they were on my mind, like the song too.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. All right, I've got a zillion other questions, but I promised I wouldn't hog you. So we're going to talk to Marty and to Cleveland Dennis, if I can actually do this here. we shall see. All right, so conferencing is not necessarily my forte, but let's see what Marty in Whiting, welcome to WGN Radio.
Good evening, Raleigh.
So tell me, talk to Dell. I'm not the hit here. He is.
Dell, I got a quick question. I'm a huge sports fan, particularly baseball, but any story from the book about meeting a professional athlete, particularly baseball?
No baseball, but there's one in there. Bill Wade, the football player from the Chicago Bears.
Oh, wow.
I was asked to meet with this guy, and they just mentioned his name, William Wade. He's looking for a job. And as I recount in the story, the bank changes and mergers and everything. After he left football, he was worked at a bank in Nashville. And he lost his job. He was in his late 50s, around 60. And all of a sudden, he's sitting in front of me. And then I realize all of a sudden, wait a second. This is Bill Wade, a football player. You know, won the NFL championship in, what, 61 with the Bears and all this. And he told me a fantastic story about how he lost the opportunity to be the successor to Papa Bear, the George Halas. And because he did not understand, it's a great story because it's so sad.
It is,
and it's. I'm not going to spoil it. I mean, get the book and read it. It's a great sports story.
It's worth it alone, and it'll literally make you cry. And talk about a missed opportunity. Oh my dear God.
Yeah,
well, I can't wait to buy it.
All right, thanks, Marty. Appreciate the call.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. So let's. Let's see what is on Cleveland Dennis's mind. Welcome back to WGN Radio.
I find the conversation quite interesting because every time, or the longer I listen, even though I missed a portion when I was on the phone with John calling in, I have comments to make and then a question or two. But Bill Wade, I still have some of his football cards.
Mm. You'll want to read this story.
Anyhow. And I will. Yeah, and Papa Bear, he was just mentioned recently because the Eastland sunk in the Chicago River. Papa Bear was supposed to be on that Eastland. I think it was electronic company in Chicago having a picnic. And when he, for whatever reason, didn't make it to the boat, kind of saved his life, because all those people that died during that tragedy. Anyhow, You Were On My Mind was mentioned by your guest that it's a happy song. I know that song. It's a drug-related song.
Well, when I went to the course, Ian and Sylvia, no shock there.
Right. But when I get to the corner to ease my mind, all right? Now, I didn't know that when it was a hit in the 60s, and I have a 45 of that one for sure, and maybe on one of the albums, but I learned later that that's what they were talking about. I'm pretty sure.
But, you know, the beautiful thing about music is it can be anything you want it to be. The heck with finding out for sure what Ian or Sylvia was thinking about.
Well, I don't know what they're thinking about. I'm just saying what I heard.
Yeah, it's a it's a heroin song, actually. I'm well aware of it.
Right. Okay. That's why, we know all about that too well in my family. But when you're talking about Ted Bundy, I knew the story pretty well over the years from different episodes of True Crime Garage. But what was the deal with his dad? Did he have a dad? Was it a stepdad? I just can't remember, and I just would like to bring that up.
That's interesting. I know Louise was his mother, and you knew her. Was there a father in the picture you knew about, Del?
He was adopted by her second husband.
Okay.
And he originally was not born Bundy. He had a different name, so he assumed his stepfather's name.
Okay, but the stepfather was there through his growing up and all that. It wasn't a single parent household.
No, I don't know all those details, but I'm sure somebody's really analyzed his life.
Oh yeah, I'm positive of that. Yeah. All right, Dennis, thank you for calling. It's always good to hear from you. All right, so we will, now there's, you know, we talk about missed opportunities as well, not only Mr. Wade, but you almost missed one, and I want to pick that up next, how many times you turned down the story of J.P. Nunnally. So it's all in Colored Pebbles, and that is available to you, and you will like it. Now, what I love about it is that it is, like I say, probably three dozen or more stories that are woven together. But if you're saying, I don't have time to read a book, this is the kind of thing where you can read a story, put it down, and then pick it up with the next story whenever you want to, and it makes it a pleasure to read. I just loved every word. So 888-876-5593 if you want the last word, but I have a feeling I'm going to hog. Del, coming up on WGN Radio.
Like the pine trees lining the winding road, I've got a name, I've got a name. Like the singing bird and the croaking toad, I've got a name, I've got a name. And I carry it with me like my daddy did, but I'm living the dream that he kept here. Moving me down the highway, rolling me down the highway, moving ahead so life won't pass me by. Like a north wind whistling down the sky, I've got a song, I've got a song. Like the whippoorwill and the baby's cry, I've got a song, I've got a song. And I carry it with me and I sing it loud. If it gets me nowhere, I go there proud. Moving me down the highway, rolling me down the highway, moving ahead so life won't.
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James, and that was Del Stecker's third request. Jim Croce, I Got a Name, released one day after he died in a plane crash. He died September 20th, 1973, and on the 21st, that record dropped. And they're planning to, obviously, release it anyway, and it became a top 10 hit, as you can obviously tell. So I'm going to run out of time here, and I got one story I got to get to, because, Del, I absolutely understand why you would turn down anything that was submitted to you for all the reasons we know. And here comes a guy who is unrelenting in saying, you got to read my father's notes. You just got to read his letters. And eventually you succumbed. And that was an interesting reason as to why. But tell me about J.P. Nunnally.
Harold, his son, read the book about my dad on a ship. And somebody told him, you know, here's this book about your dad's ship, too. And his father was on the ship. He was not one of the original plankholders, but he was there for a good part of their service in the war. And Harold had these heartrending letters, and he said, you got to read them. And I just blew them off. I said, no, I don't want to. I was advised by Pat Conroy, the writer, don't use other people's material. You're going to get in trouble and all that.
Right.
And I kept on saying no and no and no. And finally, I said, okay, I'll read a couple of them just to get them off my back. And he sent me a couple. I read them, and I called him back, and I said, if you got any more, I want them. They're wonderful. And it's the most heartrending story. And it's I don't believe in channeling, but if I was ever channeled or involved in it, when I wrote the book about JP's experience called Sailor Man, I had to read those letters backwards, forwards, up and down. They're heartrending. It's the most wonderful anti-war book, I think. I've had a lot of people compliment me telling JP's story, but I really, you know, it got the gold medal for memoirs from the Military Writers Society of America. And when the gold medal, like this.
Yeah, this is wonderful. And I hate to do this. People are going to have to read Sailor Man, but Colored Pebbles as well. We've just blown through an hour. So I hope we can do it again, Del.
Anytime.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. So, yeah, I could talk for the next 2 hours. And Colored Pebbles, absolutely worth the read. True about Sailor Man, too. It's all on Raleigh.net. You can get the links, and we'll pick it up right there. If it's on your mind, it'll be on mine right here on WGN Radio.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go. And all the noise and the hurry seem to help, I know. Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose? The lights are much brighter there. You can forget all your troubles, forget all. Your problems surround you. There are movie shows downtown. Maybe you know some little places to go where they never close. Downtown, just listen to the rhythm of a gentle bossa nova. You'll be dancing with them too before the night is over.
WGN Radio, I'm Raleigh James. Well, Naoto in Japan requested it, so how could I refuse? Well, there are probably ways, let us count them. Mrs. Miller, the sad, sad story is that she did not know she was a joke. She was as serious as a heart attack. She was a woman who, as a child, grew up in, like, Joplin, Missouri, but then married well. Her husband was a big industrialist and investor-type guy, and, like, 30 years older than her. And she wound up living in Claremont. and you know, which is a section of Los Angeles, you know, far east. And if you know the area and the Claremont colleges, you know it. It's surrounded by blue bloods and stuff like that as well. And so she was a society matron, as it were. And in fact, she insisted on being called Mrs. Miller. Her first name was Elva, but she would prefer you didn't use it. And she was to be charitable, an untrained mezzo soprano. Well, what happened was she put this out on her own labels, actually. She was at Pomona College studying, you know, composition and voice, and she, you know, obviously had the money through her husband and self-financed a number of things, whether it was classical or gospel or children. Children, the slumber song was interesting because Gary Owens got a hold of it. She actually had given it to a lot of local orphanage. I don't know how Gary, and he was at the time, he was still at KFWB. This is before he went to KMPC, and he put her on the air, obviously as a joke, but you know, she did not realize that the joke was on her on any level. And so actually this got a lot of people talking and laughing, and ultimately she got shopped to labels, and it was Lex Azevedo, who well-known guy who, actually, if you knew about the easy listening format that Bonneville did, he produced all those, you know, Steppenwolf with strings stuff. But nonetheless, he was a house producer at Capitol at the time in 1965, and he signed her. And so it was that they put out Mrs. Miller's Greatest Hits. Yeah, right. And it sold over 250,000 copies in the first 3 weeks. And they had a couple other Capitol albums, Will Success Spoil Mrs. Miller and The Country Soul of Mrs. Miller. And, you know, literally completely oblivious to why people were buying this stuff. Completely. She wound up doing a tour of Vietnam, you know, for the American troops, like a USO deal, and she appeared at the Hollywood Bowl and all this. Man, you got to hear her version of It's Magic, or maybe you don't. But and the bottom line, in 1968, they dropped her after the joke was starting to get old. But she continued to sing on various labels, and no success whatsoever. And after her husband died, she was living in a condo in Northridge when the earthquake hit, and in 1994, the earthquake hit. She wound up going to a retirement home in Vista Garden Terrace, and that's where she died in 97, and she's interred in Pomona. So that's the story of Mrs. Miller, and she looked the part, too. Oh, my dear God. This was good stuff. You should see her picture with her and Jimmy Durante in an appearance on the Hollywood Palace. Yeah, right. Okay. So that's it for Mrs. Miller. And I hope Nayota was listening, because God knows I don't want to play it again. 888-876-5593-8888 Raleigh. And yes, we will we'll do the whole story of You Were On My Mind. But I didn't want to interrupt Dell with minutia like that. And Colored Pebbles is absolutely worth the read. And We Five, though, was one of his three bumper requests. You Were On My Mind, and yes, but it's interesting because the We Five version was actually not patterned off of the original Ian and Sylvia. Sylvia wrote it. It was Crispian St. Peter's, on Decca in the UK, I think on Jamie here, put it out before the We Five got a hold of it. All right, we might chat about that in the original lyrics. And a whole verse was missing from the We Five version. But it was a song about a heroine or failed relationships, depending on how you like to look at it. James is on the South Side. Welcome to WGN Radio, James.
How are you?
Well, I'm here. How are you?
Oh, I'm hanging in here. I had a few stories. I had the one about the mailman who went 52 miles to make sure the piece of mail got to the one person.
Yeah, that was a real feel-good story. And you had a couple of them, like the Chick-fil-A employee that we'll get to. But yes, what was nice about the mail person is ultimately he was recognized, including, I don't know that there was any bonus or anything, but recognized by his superiors and everybody else for that. And nice to hear that. Just like nice to hear about the kid, literally a teen, who finds $10,000 at Chick-fil-A and immediately turns it in. Good for him.
Yeah, because as they say, good work goes hard to find.
Now, you had a story that you sent that was timely for me because, you know, we were back at the Globe Studio this week and I've been cleaning out things like old food and things like that. And horrible to believe, but I had things in my refrigerator from 2014. Fortunately, it wasn't like fruit. All right, but you had an article on 13 foods you should never read after they never eat after they expire. And I found that interesting to a degree because most stuff you can get away with. Now, infant formula, yeah, no, that's a no-brainer. I would expect that. And as far as meat, though, especially ground beef and chicken. Chicken can be just terrible. You want to watch it. Eggs, I didn't realize that much about eggs because I must admit I am one who is willing to eat them a few months old, a few years, maybe not. But they're saying that yeah, eggs can be a real problem. Likewise with soft cheeses. Now deli meat, I would expect. But then fiddleheads, I thought, well, I don't have to worry about throwing out fiddleheads because I have no idea what they are.
I didn't even look. I said, what? I wouldn't even touch.
Yeah, right. Tightly coiled asparagus-like ferns. That does not sound appetizing to me. And it says,
I like the asparagus with the spears.
Yeah.
Not the...
All right. Can produce toxins that make you sick if eaten past the expiration date. Well, they have nothing to worry about. I am not eating tightly coiled asparagus-like ferns, expired or not. Ground spices, this was a surprise to me, because I am always saying there's no problem. All that it means is they might not be as potent. And I kind of still stand with that, and the article really didn't dissuade me. But restaurant leftovers... And, you know, I didn't realize that the lowly chicken can be the absolute worst when it comes to leftovers. And apparently, refrigeration slows down the bacterial growth, but doesn't stop it.
Oh, remember I don't know. Okay, there was a line. There was a scene from the movie The Naked Gun where, okay, the Leslie Nielsen has invited Priscilla Presley over, okay, and then say the refrigerator, he doesn't, being a policeman, he sometimes obviously doesn't get a chance to do much cooking. But she knows, oh, I thought this Chinese restaurant went out of business. he falls out.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Raw fish, well, that should be a no-brainer, but I guess, right? But, you know, while people will think about fish or maybe chicken or something like that, we don't tend to think about leafy greens or vegetables, but that can be an absolute killer, which I had no idea. Nuts, now... Interestingly, when I was reading about this, of course, they go rancid because of the oils and the things like that. And I will tell you, I had a run-in with a bag of potato chips the other night. There's nothing like rancid potato chips. They do. They get bitter and certainly not tasty. I'm not sure that the nuts are going to do you in, but I'm pretty sure you'll stop eating them.
Oh yeah, I think I think the main thing that, especially with potato chips, oh goodness, if you let them, okay, you think you're going to stretch it, don't do that because they get real, like, kind of like hard to chew. Even if you got great chompers, you'll think, I'm wasting my chompers on something. Like, it could be on carrots, would be a much better alternative.
Yeah, but not nearly as much fun. You're right about the texture, but I didn't mind that part. You know, I actually kind of liked the fact that the texture was going to be a challenge. But it was the flavor. It's bitter. It's sour. It's awful. And so, yeah, I guess that's one where you don't need a sell-by date. You just take a bite and say, I think I'll stop eating this now.
Oh, let me tell you about another one they don't mention. Okay, soda. A Pepsi, if you get it past its sale date, if you drink it past the sale date, let's just say you'll realize why it was a medicinal at one time.
Oh, geez. Well, I assume that also depends if it's bottled. If it's in a glass bottle and it is sealed, it's going to last a while. But when it goes, the problem is that usually the carbonation is what will go. And, of course, as soon as I know that, I don't go any further.
Yeah, it's... The problem is sometimes even with the you sometimes have a hard time reading an expiration date.
Oh, they're pretty clear, most of them. You're right, some of them are, but a lot of them are pretty darn clear. All right, so now we have from food we shouldn't eat, we have a steakhouse that is in bankruptcy. And that's interesting. And so I must admit that I don't know that much about this place. And
I don't think there's one in this state.
Yeah, and you know that could be a problem. 801 Chop House. So apparently, if you live in Denver, Des Moines, Iowa, Kansas City, St. Louis, Leawood, Kansas, Minneapolis, Omaha, or Tyson's Corner, Virginia, you've heard of it. Anywhere else, I guess you haven't. So there was one on Nicollet Mall in Minneapolis, 801, that closed. But yet another one bites the dust. Why are we surprised about that?
Yeah, and I've heard about shopping malls basically. So slowly biting the dust one after another.
Yeah, not even slowly. I find this to be an alarming trend because most places it's either too cold and in winter or too hot in summer to be outdoors. So the idea of the enclosed mall, I think, was a godsend in the 60s when it started, and really in the 50s, but 60s for most of us. And more... these malls are completely closing. They've been redeveloped, and they herald all these, redevelopments, which invariably have you outside. And again, you know, if you're in Yuma, it's hot in summer. If you're in Minneapolis, it's cold in winter. There are a few places other than maybe San Diego where you'll do this 12 months a year. So I don't get it.
Yeah, it's sad. Like, I'll give you an example. Okay. Evergreen Park Plaza was, when it first opened in, I think, 1952, was enclosed, and it was for most of it until the early 2000s, when it almost went complete, was in bankruptcy. The village, basically, along with some other interest, managed to bring it out of it, and then redeveloped, but it became outdoor.
Well, this is interesting. When the plaza, when that opened in 1952, I did not know that was enclosed then. That's fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Then that would be the first.
Yeah, it was, and they had an artwork by Art. I'm trying to think of the architect. I can't think of his name right offhand now.
Yeah.
But it had this artwork there the sculpture work that was all scattered throughout the plaza, and they were one of the ones that had like the early jogging thing they allowed. And you will come in about 8 or so, you could jog around, but unfortunately, probably one of the things that didn't go well for it, and I think they made certain that they could.
While we've been talking, in 1952 it opened as an open air shopping mall, and it didn't get enclosed until later. All right, I would be very surprised that anything was enclosed in 1952 because I've sort of looked at this a lot, and I wonder when they enclosed it. I'll try to find out.
Yeah, because I knew it was 1952, but I didn't. But when I first started, which was a kid in the 1970s, oh my. They had this theater. Maybe they did it when they got the theater. Maybe.
Okay, May 19th, 1966. In August of 1952, it opened as an open-air shopping center, converted into the nation's first suburban indoor mall during the 60s remodeling, May 19th, 1966.
Okay.
So there you go. All the courts and concourses were enclosed, making it Chicagoland's first indoor mall. And then 2013, it was closed and demolished. And, of course, it returns to an open-air format. I don't get this.
And I think I know why, because part of it, okay, in its late years, okay, the roof part was leaking. They had buckets all the way around right near the old Montgomery Ward.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, it clearly would have needed a serious, serious rehab, but I just don't understand. And this is not there. It's virtually every one of these malls. Now, if it's not open air, worse than that, are they make it out like they're these mini old town downtowns, you know, where you walk the streets, and the parking is abysmal in these places. And there's a bunch of them. And I'll tell you what, I go out of my way not to go to any of those redeveloped malls.
And then, there's one that's getting ready on the south side to slowly die, if it hasn't died already, Ford City.
Okay. Well, you know, as far as that, malls across the country are dying. There's no doubt about it. And that's been going on now probably 20 years. And you can see all sorts of websites of, you know, some of the things that will just bring you to tears. And that I get. I just don't understand why we don't redevelop them as something else that's enclosed.
Yeah, that would make sense, but they're not thinking on that.
Well, clearly. And by the way, you've ended the half hour, so we'll talk to you soon. Thank you for the links. Much appreciated.
You're welcome.
All right, so that's where we'll pick it up after the news right here on WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James, and that is a wonderful song. And actually, I heard it when I got that album on Swan, because of Who Do You Love? I Want to Know. And that was on. And that became the flip side of probably the second single. And that was really nice too. And Kenny Gamble, of course, mostly responsible for that. Joe Renzetti did the arranging, and Joe was an interesting guy. He was the house guitarist for Cameo, but he was great as far as arranging and producing. But if you look at the label, it'll say it's written by Kenny Gamble and Jerry Ross. I don't know what Jerry can do. Yeah, that's a long story, but it was certainly Kenny Gamble, and a fine song it was, and that was a request, I believe, I had it here, from, I diligently wrote this stuff down, from Mike in Cleveland. Yes, I found out too late. All right, Mike, I think I played all three of yours now, at least, I hope I did. All right, so 888-876-5593-8888-Raleigh. And what do we have? I believe Nick in Baltimore. Welcome to WGN Radio.
Hey, good morning, Wally. Thank you.
What's happening?
Well, I wanted to start off with something that James was talking about, the malls closing. We just found out that Towson Town Mall's closing.
Yes, I heard that. And that, it's terrible. And I looked up the stats during the news trying to do something purposeful, which is rare, and I discovered that there hasn't been one new enclosed mall built in America since 2006. And they're not doing it. And however, there's been over 1,600 that have closed. So the numbers are huge. But see, I just don't buy what they say in terms of that people don't want the enclosed malls. And that is, but you dig a little deeper and you find out, well, there's some economic issues. E-commerce really has put a dent in this. Also, very few anchor stores now because, of course, you know, they're all Macy's or Dillard's. And so you don't get the deals you used to get. So I think there's economic reasons, but I still say the average person probably would prefer to be in enclosed comfort than out in the elements.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't know. I agree with you, but I think it has a lot to do with the crime stats plus also the e-commerce, like you're saying.
Yeah. Now, they say that of course it does. I agree with that 100%. Apple is closing in Towson in June, yep. I think. And there are others that, you know, the leases are up and all that. But I don't think that mall is completely closing. I think they're going to do something. And I don't remember what it is they're going to do.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because there will be some development there. You know,
yeah.
I've always said this whole country is really great, has great property. But, you know, we're talking East Coast, beachfront property, all of it.
Yeah.
Really. And there will be development. Whether I'm around to see it,
you know, well, you're right, exactly.
Doesn't matter.
Right. Yeah, well, it will be interesting, but yeah, they'll do something with that site. That's Brookfield owns that, and they're not just going to let it go fallow. Oh, they'll do something.
Well, yeah.
Hopefully, it's not a medical center. Okay.
No. Yeah. Probably condominiums.
Yeah. Or some. Oh God, yeah, they're doing that a lot. Mixed use areas.
Yeah. Real quick, I wanted to bring up. There's so many topics I wanted to hit on. You know, you guys got me thinking about food and restaurants, you know, steakhouses closing. And,
yeah.
And great places to eat, you know. Yeah, so, I wanted to bring up classic qualities that are gone.
Yeah. Now, by the way, interestingly, you know, no, there are no new three-letter calls. However, under FCC regulations, you can reclaim a three-letter call that you used to have, assuming yep. that they're, you know, not in use and all that. They'll let you reclaim them.
Well, they did that with Jay-Z.
Mm-hmm. So they still will do that.
Now, what is the deal, though, with the Jay-Z calls? I know they stood for Jersey, but in terms of, is there a licensing thing with CBS, since CBS owns the TV station, did the radio stations enter into some sort of licensing deal?
You know, you used to be, of course, when the TV and radio completely split, you had to do something with your calls, like for KOB and Albuquerque, add a K, KKOB, you know, things like that. Yeah, as far as Jay-Z, that was an assigned call. They didn't pick it. And that was 21, I think, Westinghouse at the time in Newark.
Right.
And I think it stood for Jersey Zone, but I'm not 100% sure about that. But
well,
it was
that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I don't know what it means, but it does. They said it stood for Jersey. I remember Jersey Zone flagship for NBC Blue. And then Ed Noble bought it. And then, of course, you know, it became ABC and all that. But the Baltimore connection, and that may be why you're interested in 57, Westinghouse bought WAAM-TV, and they changed the calls to WJZ-TV, which, of course, the original station became WABC-TV in New York, Channel 7. So the Jay-Z calls, I think, are still in Baltimore, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so
yeah, they're on radio and TV.
Right, Right. So there you go with that. Well, the FM is that's a Catonsville license, I think. It's not a Baltimore license. Yeah. That 105.7. I know it's not a Baltimore license, but I don't remember.
Yeah.
I think it's Catonsville.
That's the old CBC.
Yeah, CBC, and then BMD. Yeah.
And KTK.
Right. And of course, half a dozen other things. For a while, it was HFS. So,
I forgot about that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, for a minute and a half, right? So, and
yeah.
what I found interesting when they were QSR, they were going to be one of the stations for Super Radio, you know, that format that ABC was going to originate. Yeah, right. Well,
speaking of a minute.
Yeah. Right. It never happened. I remember in Broadcasting Magazine for a year, ABC had these ads, Super Radio is coming. And then a friend of mine who was a graphic artist, the week after it was announced, Super Radio is gone. And I think I still have that somewhere. So it never did launch. But QSR kept the call letters, and then I guess it was Sonics that bought it.
So. Didn't they, the story I heard on that, was that the six stations that signed up for it, was it, I think, six stations or four stations, and the Baltimore station was one of them.
Right.
There was one in Braddock, Pennsylvania, one in Baltimore, the one in Buffalo, and there was another one or two stations. I forget which ones, but didn't they all get together and scream at ABC and say, you can't leave us high and dry, you gotta help us. And so didn't they come in? I heard they came in to each town and consulted and put a format in there.
You know, I heard that they had done things as well, but there was never anything that was codified. You know, so... And originally, remember, it is 82, they delayed. They didn't say, we're not doing it. They delayed it. They delayed it indefinitely 2 weeks before it was scheduled to begin. And there were those six stations, and it became quite the deal as far as that goes. And but they said it was going to be postponed, and I think one of them was KBRA in Wichita, and that general manager really was upset. I remember that. I forget his name, but he was very upset. And so that Wichita thing, and like you mentioned, the Buffalo thing, and I guess it was WWOL, and there was another one as well, and there was one in Columbus. And so, it was a real weird thing, because the general managers, you know, they were just fit to be tied. It's interesting. Others say, well, our research showed that we should go from beautiful music to adult contemporary. And I don't know that I would have termed it adult contemporary, but that's what they were doing. And I remember shortly before they actually went on hold, so to speak, they at one of the NABs, the one that was right before that, they had a big presentation where you sat down and you saw all they were going to do and all that. And at the end of it, they handed out pens and said, you can use this pen to sign up for the greatest revolution in radio history, or you can just keep your pen. I kept my pen. So...
And it's a collector's item.
Yeah, right. And I still got it somewhere, I do believe. But, that was their big thing about the pen. Or you can just have a pen. And I thought, hell, the people who kept the pen got more than the people who signed up for the deal. So, you know, sadly.
But, you know, the only thing I remember about that, Raleigh, was that I was coming home from work one day, and I had my radio on, and I was listening, and... I heard these construction sounds on 105.7. We're building a brand new radio station.
Oh, man.
And the next morning, well, actually, it went off at midnight. And then the next morning, it was, you know, Super Radio WQSR, and they did the top 40 format. But it was kind of and then it slowly evolved into oldies. And it became successful. But I guess your buddy Randy Kova came in and consulted that, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. Now, interestingly, when Super Radio went down, I forget which general manager it was, but he had the best line for this, I thought. They had a $1 million product at ABC and a 10-cent sales force. I thought that was a great line. But the six general managers who were interviewed at the time, and I don't remember all six, obviously, but I think they were all in concert, that they really believed that if this actually went on the air, this would be a success. You know, they didn't give up on that, but they that's why they were so ticked at ABC, you know, saying, you know, you should have seen this through, you should have seen it through, and you should have forecasted your problems before you were selling it to us. And they were right. So, yeah.
Well, what drove it, though? What drove it was the ABC Talk Radio was, you know, signing up all these AM stations. And so they...
Of course.
They figured they'd do,
Of course. Well, you know, have satellite, will travel. And, of course, ABC had the best vantage point for satellite availability. You know, a lot of transponders and dishes and all that. In fact, they were, you know, the eminent provider of that. And I remember when, what was his name who got fired? I can't think of it. But and he left. I don't know that they claimed it was a firing, but it was a firing. The guy at ABC who allegedly came up with Rush. I say allegedly because actually he wasn't so much sold on him as they sold it. But when he left ABC, whose name is escaping me, he got, as I used to call them, deluxe parting gifts. He got the use of satellite time, and that's how he was able to put Rush on that. So, you know, the early to mid-80s. Because, you know, when 1980 began and you were starting to see that this is coming, it wasn't originally going to be SATCOM 3 and all that. Remember, originally it was SSS out of Tulsa. And so you had people on these obscure satellites where you had to have, you know, dishes to have it, you know, work and all that. But ultimately, when SATCOM, you know, launched and all that stuff, I mean, that... all of a sudden, you no longer had to be wired. And this was a complete change because before having to be wired, you know, there were never going to be more than four networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, and, of course, Mutual. And, of course, of those, they divided their niche formats, you know, the source at NBC and all those others and, you know, the 27 ABC networks or whatever, of course. But once the satellite time was available, I used to laugh and say, yeah, it's Joe's Satellite and Grill. Anybody could be a network overnight. You know, so, and we saw that, but yeah, Ed, what was Ed's last name? But anyway, it might come to me or not, doesn't matter, but he's the guy who got the satellite time as part of his parting gifts. And then put Rush on.
That was why I never knew that.
Well, what's interesting that, you know, Rush was originally two radio stations. He was going to be on KFI in Los Angeles, WABC in New York. Well, WABC still... even with all this stuff, wasn't sold that national talk radio was the way to go. So for the first year or two, Rush had to do 2 hours local on WABC and then 2 hours on the national show. Yeah. And
I remember that.
Right, right. So that tells you how skittish they still were. And so a lot of things happened in the 80s. But yeah, that was the deal. Ed McLaughlin, that was his name. All right. So I knew it would come to me. And Bruce Marr at WABC, who had been at KABC. Bruce Marr is the one who convinced him, saying, yeah, this guy in Sacramento, you need to do him. And that's how that happened.
Wasn't the ABC talk radio, though, wasn't that really KABC?
Yeah, and KGO.
And KGO,
Now, remember, because and I'm going to have to do commercials, but we're going to come back in a moment. But remember why KABC and KGO were all talk in 1960. And we'll go back to that in a minute right here on WGN Radio.
I must confess that I cry from loneliness, and the door is still open to my heart. You are to me like the honey is to the bee, and the door to my heart.
WGN Radio, I'm Ronnie James. The Cardinals, 1955 on Atlantic, and that's the first of Jimmy P's six-pack. He'll be hearing all six within the next couple nights, and the rest of your requests as well. I promised Ken we'd have Larry Gatlin on. We'll do that next. So what are we doing? I believe Ralph is what we're doing. All right, Ralph is in Rockford. Welcome back to WGN Radio. What's happening, Ralph?
Well, thank you. When I heard you mention Christian St. Peter's, and I must say you were on my mind, because I wanted to just file a most obediently a little report with you that I saw him live in 91 in Antwerp, Belgium.
Really?
Yeah, well, in Antwerp, Belgium, you know, is the diamond city of the world.
Of course, absolutely.
Of course, and I always liked the coast, the Belgian coast. It's very nice there, and they have one of the most beautiful cities of Western Europe, and that's Bruges.
Mm-hmm.
Bruges, yeah, it's wonderful there, and I used to go to Knokke and Ostende, and believe it or not, when you go all the way down the coast up to the Pan, you are in France.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's how I got to go to Antwerp, and I heard about this big concert they had there. They had 18 or more all the top English groups. Can you imagine that many groups?
Sure.
So that was wonderful. I saw the Tremolos, the Talks, Fortunes and Mike Pendle Searchers.
Well, interesting because, of course, less than 4 years after you saw him, he suffered a really debilitating stroke, and then he wound up dying from pneumonia in 2003.
Yeah,
but, yeah.
Well, that's one thing I was going to mention now. I mean, I'm glad you told me about it, because in 91, when his turn came up, I'm sure he must have been English, because he said, it's me voice. Yeah, and
well,
he couldn't.
You know, yeah. He was his own worst enemy, as you probably know. When he had You Were On My Mind, and we'll play a little of that, because that's what influenced the Wee Five. But when he had that out, and it was a hit in Great Britain, he did this interview where he said that he was a better songwriter than the Beatles and a better onstage performer than Elvis. And he was more talented than Sammy Davis Jr. and sexier than Dave Berry and more exciting than Tom Jones. Well, hell, he says this to a journalist, and he says, "I make Elvis Presley look like the Statue of Liberty." And so you can imagine. And so that was pretty much it, and nothing else hit, and then Decca dropped him, and he had a nervous breakdown, and then he tried to come back as a country performer, and then he tried gospel, and but you know, I can't imagine saying that kind of stuff. I just can't imagine.
I cannot either. That's very, very unwise to say. You only make enemies with that, you know.
Well,
and,
of course.
Yeah, worse. And in the music business, you know it yourself, especially he only was possibly a one-hit wonder with You Were On My Mind and Pied Piper.
Right. And in the United States, Pied Piper really was it.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And so why he would have such a big mouth, I have no idea, but that was possibly the beginning of his downfall.
I wondered if he was doing drugs. I mean, I don't know.
Well,
I have no reason to think that. But the first thing I thought when I heard that Elvis Statue of Liberty stuff is that the guy must be on drugs.
Yeah, he was. When he said that, he must have been somewhere else, but not in this world.
Right, exactly. You know? And he never had like a documented drug problem or whatever. So I can't begin to understand what would possess him to do that.
I cannot either, because do you know he was from England, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And born and bred. Yeah. And he was born in Kent, in Swanley in Kent, and he died in Kent.
Yeah.
So not all that far from home. So yeah, he was you know, after school he took guitar lessons and all that. And in 54 he became a worked at a movie theater as an assistant projectionist and things like that. And then he got into these bands, none of which anybody ever heard of. And first time he was on stage, 1956, was the Hard Travelers. If you've heard the Hard Travelers, you're doing better than me. And then he wound up doing some, like, not like the Army, but whatever national service is over there. I don't know. And then he was in these other bands that no one has ever heard about, the, one of which was the Beat Formula. And and when he was in the Beat Formula, who were very forgettable, David Nicholson, who was a publicist for EMI, became his manager.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, his name was not obviously Crispian St. Peter's; it was Robin Smith. And so, it was David at EMI who originally gave him the name Crispin Blackie, and then subsequently Crispian St. Peter's. And he claimed he was 19 years old. Yeah, well, that, unfortunately, he was 24 at the time. But that never stopped a publicist. So, you know that, and it was Nicholson who got him signed to Decca. And that was in the UK, obviously, and that's what did it. You know, got him on Ready, Steady, Go, you know, that kind of stuff. But
that was
right.
Ready, Steady, Go. I think that was
Hullabaloo and Shindig and everything else all combined. Yes, it was the show to be on if you had to be on anything over there. And in the US, it was on Jamie. Why Jamie signed it, I don't know. But the Pied Piper was really about it.
Well, that was in England. I remember that Ready, Steady, Go. That was
big, very big, yeah.
Wasn't that Cliff Richard in there or something?
Ready, Steady, Go was like the biggest thing. And, you know, remember, of course, British television, it's primarily... you know, government controlled. So to even have that is utterly alarming. And it was RSG, Ready, Steady, Go, and that was from 63 through 66, I think. So it wasn't a long time, but it was huge. Elkin Allen created that show, and it was big. And, you know, they had it on early Friday night. The weekend starts here. And then they played Wipeout by the Safaris at first. Then they changed it to a Manfred Mann record. I think Hubble Bubble Toll in Trouble. But it was.
That was
That was on there, I think. And so it was not a BBC show. BBC was Top of the Pops, but it was sanctioned, so to speak. Associated Rediffusion. It was, it was, and it was interesting because when I say it's on early Friday evening, if you remember, depending where in the UK, the local news preempted parts of this show.
The British have always been tremendously proud of the BBC. That because you used to be in this, area too.
So but for 3 years it was a big youth following, and
I remember that also Cliff Richard, his real name was Harry Webb.
Yeah.
That was his real name. And Cliff Richard, he had taken for, I think he had a show too, could have been earlier or so, but he took from Little Richard.
Right.
He took the Ready, Teddy, Go or something like that when he started.
Right, exactly. So it was bizarre. And he was in India for a while, his family, you know, earlier.
You mean Cliff Richard?
Yes, absolutely.
He was. I think he might have been even born in India, I think, maybe.
I think so, but not a place I've heard of. It's supposedly part of the UK, but I think it was something called like Lucknow. Now, where Lucknow is, I have no idea. Maybe I need to get a map, but I don't know. But you know, he wound up. Well, obviously, he wound up to be a very big deal. Obviously, he was with the Drifters, not our Drifters, their Drifters. But while he was with the Drifters, that's when he changed his name. And and they were debating between Cliff and Rock. and then I think it was the guy who wrote Move It who said, be Richard as a tribute to Little Richard. So it could have been Rock, but it turned out to be Cliff. And that was the deal. And so it was 58 when he adopted the name.
Yeah.
And,
That's when his big time started, 57, 58, 59.
Yeah, right, and right. The first record he released was a cover of a Bobby Helms flop, Schoolboy Crush. You know, I mean, it didn't hit here. Why did they think it would hit there? But, as far as that goes.
He had one hit here. I believe in the America Top 20 in 59 with the Living Doll.
Oh, yeah, well, Living Doll was big. He had another hit here, too, Devil Woman in the 70s, but...
Yeah, Devil Woman, but of course, they did not want... I can understand why they did not want him to interfere with Elvis,
exactly. Well, you know, it's interesting because after the first flop when he did Move It, John Lennon actually publicly had said Move It was the first British rock record. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that was John Lennon claiming it. And, of course, he claimed he was bigger than Jesus, too, but so what? So, yeah, Living Doll was big. And, there were a number of things. But, yeah, he became, and, of course, you know, EMI was behind him all the way. So there was a lot of money. A lot of money behind this guy. And
they were making big money with him because he was also somewhat of a star. Almost all over Western Europe.
Right. And he was in movies, you know. He was in Serious Change and The Young Ones. You know.
One of his big hits, too, yeah.
Right. And so, he was with the Shadows for a while. And then the Shadows had covered Jörgen Ingman with Apache, and that was...
Jörgen Ingman, he was from Sweden.
Yeah.
He had the Apache... That was the biggest hit he had.
Right, exactly. So he did that. And then, of course, here comes the British invasion, if you will. And Cliff Richard was not the Mersey Sound, to say the least.
No.
So it's a wonder, it's a wonder that he, survived it and thrived, because most people, that would have been it.
I think he survived and thrived because he had a lot of money and thus a lot of publicity.
Right, and he did well in Eurovision, and that's a big deal every year. Yeah. And so he did real well in Eurovision in the latter '60s and all that. So, he was he was about as big as it gets. So,
over there and at the time.
Right. Oh yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And so. I think he formally changed his name, but I don't think that was like till 1980, and then he became a Sir. They gave him a title, and all that.
Oh yeah, title every time
they had a knight.
Every time you contribute so much to the English crown's money.
Yeah, tax. Absolutely. You know. So he was appointed a knight bachelor. and that cost him a fortune. Absolutely. I think, and I don't know this, but I think he's still alive.
Yeah, I think he must be about mid-80s.
85. So. Yeah, he'd be 86 this year because he was born in 1940.
Yeah. And, he was, I think he was good friends with Dave Clark 5.
That's not surprising. It was surprising Dave Clark became a star here, but, you know, of course, they were looking for anybody because, you know, Dave was, I think, not really the British invasion type, per se. But he went on to quite a career, you know, business-wise and all that. He did fine for himself.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, he was pretty clever, and they even had, at the time there, they bought and owed some kind of a plane, and they flew in the plane with this to the concert.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was called DC-5, that
right.
plane.
Right, right. So he did very well. And but Dave Clark, the one friendship that sort of seemed weird to me is one of his closest friends was Freddie Mercury.
Oh, yeah. Well, Freddie Mercury, see, that kind of leans, of course, towards being gay. You know that. You know that. That was Freddie Mercury, maybe Dave Clark, maybe Cliff Richard.
Right.
And,
also interesting that they didn't give Dave a sir title, because they certainly had a court case with him. He lost it, by the way. He owed a lot of money, because apparently he didn't pay any taxes on one of his albums. It was serious. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, he probably owed several million then.
Yeah, I don't know. But he somehow survived it, but it was a very big deal at the at the time. I remember. I don't know all the details, and I assume that he figured he didn't have to pay it because the sales were, you know, not British sales. Well, it doesn't exactly work like that, and so you know, it was a weird thing on that, and of course, you know, bringing this full circle. Dave Clark got the rights to Ready, Steady, Go.
Oh, yeah, right. And then, of course, his breakthrough hit was Glad All Over.
Yeah. Yep. Interestingly, I just looked this up. I wanted to see about this court case. It was the mid-70s, and he had been residing in the United States for a year. So he didn't pay any taxes to Great Britain on the proceeds of a release.
Oh.
Well, the British government challenged it, and ultimately the British government lost.
That was quite an ordeal there.
Yeah, I want to find out more about that, to say the least. But, you know, I assume that the sales weren't UK sales and he wasn't there. So, yeah, there you go. Interesting. And so, but he was definitely a businessman. You know, he made all the band members sign over their copyrights to him and all this stuff. And, you know, he was not that different from Dick Clark, actually.
at least they had the same last name.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And that was his name, too. David Clark. It absolutely was his name. All right.
Good
to talk to you.
As usual. Yeah. Nice talking to you again. And I think over the weekend we have a high visit of the king from England is going to be in the United States, I believe.
Really? Oh, man. Well,
yeah, I think so.
If you check it out, you can give me the first-hand report next week.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Well, I'll see what happens. Okay, well,
right.
Thank you, Ronnie.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Always nice talking to you.
Likewise.
And, have a good last 30 minutes.
That's right. The last 30 minutes. All right, thanks. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
That's right. It's my swan song. All right, we've got Robert. We've got Eduardo. We've got Chris. We've got Fran. And you, hopefully, on WGN Radio.
Been falling all by myself over and over again. Falling in love alone is easy. Staying in love alone ain't easy at all. This time's gonna be different, 'cause I'm taking somebody with me when I fall.
She's standing right here beside me, holding on to me like she's never gonna let me go. I don't know if it's forever, but love never felt any better. That's all I know. Falling in love alone is easy. Staying in love alone ain't easy at all. This time's gonna be different, 'cause I'm taking somebody with me when I fall.
WGN Radio, I'm Raleigh James. Larry Gatlin, 1979, he wrote it. It was Columbia at the time. Yeah, he originally debuted in Monument, 1974. Yeah, put his first little film together when I was at Epic. All right, so he did very well, to say the least. Let's see, we have Robert in LaGrange. So, Robert, welcome back to WGN Radio.
Thanks, Raleigh. I was... just thinking, I was wondering if you could give just a short synopsis of the lives and career of the great writing duo, Hal David and Burt Bacharach. You know, how they got together, if they knew each other and stuff.
Okay. Right now?
Yeah.
Okay. I could probably do that. Hal David, and they were both, guys who were born in the 20s and stuff, but... Hal David was, both New Yorkers, as far as that goes, and he had been working with a variety of things. He'd been like Sammy Kaye and Guy Lombardo and all that kind of stuff, but he wound up working at Famous Music, and that is where he got paired with Burt Bacharach in the Brill Building, and they started to publish songs, and one of the first things that happened was some of their stuff was in Don't Knock the Rock, movie.
Sure.
And so that was something, Don't Knock the Rock. But then the next year, they had written The Story of My Life, which became a huge record for Marty Robbins. And that was, that was originally in UK. It was big and all that. But here it was just huge. And then what happened into this, and they both had written with other people, most notably Hal David had. But interestingly, it was... when they got together with Dionne Warwick, who originally was just doing demos, as far as that goes. But, that stuff with Dionne Warwick just put them on the map. But they also did a lot of things for movies, like What's New Pussycat, or Alfie, or Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. They did very well. And they did some musicals, Promises, Promises, and all that kind of stuff. And what happened when they were doing their third musical, which was called Lost Horizon, and it was apparently quite the disaster. There were lawsuits, and there were... needless to say, the two of them split. And interestingly, Burt Bacharach especially made it clear that, yes, Hal David was a big part of this as far as that goes, lyrics more than anything else. And he said Hal wrote the best lyrics. But meanwhile, David went to work as a lyricist, obviously, and did things with a number of other people, like with Albert Hammond, All the Girls I've Loved Before, Willie Nelson hit and all that.
Wow.
He wrote Broken Hearted Melody that he did with Sherman Edwards, even before the big Bacharach David stuff, during Joni Summers' Johnny Get Angry, he did that. And he did stuff, like I say, Albert Hammond, but he co-wrote Sea of Heartbreak for Don Gibson, and I don't remember if it was you, but somebody requested I play that, which I will. And it was almost like a song, a big Ronnie Millsap record. So, and he did lyrics for like I don't know, the James Bond movies. And some of that was with was with Burt Bacharach. This is in the 60s, because that thing, that breakup didn't occur till about 73, I think. And so that was the deal. And he had a stroke. He was 91 years old, and that's probably now 25 years ago. I'm thinking, well, 20 years ago probably. And it seems like it anyway. So that was his deal. So a lot of Bacharach stuff, but a lot of things that that weren't, you know. I knew Burt Bacharach just through his father, because his father was actually, strangely enough, a good friend of my mother's, my adopted mom.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I remember one time when I was living in Miami, they came to town, they were plugging some book they wrote, and Senior called and all that, and we spoke to him. But I didn't know, other than that, I didn't know him, obviously, and I heard different things about, you know, he's married to Angie Dickinson for a while. That was a real big deal. And then he married Carol Bayer Sager, and they were married like a decade, but I loved her stuff. But in any event, she wrote a tell-all book about him. And man, if half of it is true, I don't even want to know. You know, it was not not good. And his dad was a kind of a journalist. I think he wrote for Menswear Daily, because he worked in the Empire State Building, which is how his father knew my mother, because my mother worked there as well. She was but he was in the Empire State Building the day that Saturday that the plane hit it. And we always knew the story about it. He ran down like 26 flights of stairs. But in any event, but because he was a journalist, Burt Jr., the kid, was born in Kansas City, where he had a writing job. And then, of course, he grew up in Forest Hills in Queens. And his mother was an amateur painter and a songwriter, as far as that goes. Wow. And so, you know, he served in the Army with Vic Damone, Burt Bacharach.
Oh, yeah.
And so I know that started. And he did a number of things with other people. And he worked at the Catskill Mountains, all those resorts, with Joel Grey and others. And you know, and so there was a deal with Marlene Dietrich. I'm trying to think what this was now, but there in the 50s. I think, like, he was her arranger and conductor. But I mean, he was like traveling with her. I have no idea what that was about, but you know, you'll always, if you look at it, you'll find pictures of them, like Marlene Dietrich and Burt Bacharach in Jerusalem, you know, or wherever. And so they traveled everywhere, and he wrote some songs and all that. And that's probably when he was working with her. That's probably when he first became known, you know, when people knew who he was and what he was doing. And then he got the job at Famous Music, and that's where he met Hal David, like I was telling you. So that story is pretty much the same.
Right.
And, after the split, he of course, you know, like I say, married Carol Bayer Sager, and they were together at the time and did some stuff. And he did some Stephanie Mills stuff. Uh-huh. And I'm trying to think what else he did. That was the deal. But the Angie Dickinson marriage was a real, you know, because of course you heard about her and JFK and all that. You know, we don't even want to know. And he actually, and I didn't see it because I don't go to movies, but appeared in an Austin Powers movie. I don't know. He had some partnership with Elvis Costello. I don't know what else. You know, this is off the top of my head. But but he went on. He continued to write with various people as far as that goes. And he did some TV stuff too. You know, like then some movie stuff. He also had other businesses. He owned a restaurant and some other things. And
invested his money, probably.
Yeah,
sure.
No, he there's no pity party for him. And and in fact, his youngest daughter is named Raleigh. How about that? And born in 1995. Doesn't spell it the same, but yes. That's the deal.
Boy, I knew I'd get a great synopsis.
It was. I'm sure if he was alive and heard it, he'd just vomit. But I'm sure I left out all the big stuff, you know. But that pretty much is close. So that, but yeah, famous music. The answer to your question is famous music was the connection that got Hal David and Burt Bacharach together.
Wow. Okay, Robbie. Thanks a lot for the info.
Oh, sure. My pleasure. Yeah. Thanks for calling. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. So 888-876-5593. 8888 Raleigh. Here's an article before Andrew Dickinson to Paula. I don't remember her last name, but Paula. All right. Eduardo in Tampa. You got news for me, Eduardo? No, because you've left the building, and who could blame you? I've waited far too long. If you call tomorrow, I promise. Well, of course, I'm talking to myself because he's asleep, but I promise I'll get to you right away. And that's probably true for Fran in Austin. Are you still with us, Fran? No. All right. But maybe she will be tomorrow night. But Chris in Greenwood, I can count on him. And there's still room for you two. And one more request. I think one of Jimmy P's six packs is appropriate. Coming up on WGN Radio. WGN Radio. I'm Robbie James, and you thought Kokomo was a song by the Beach Boys or Gene and Eunice. No, well, this is the Flamingos, 1961 on End with Kokomo. Yes, indeed. One thing I should have mentioned about Burt Bacharach, just I'll close it with this, is he was not exclusive to Hal David, even when they were writing up a storm. And at Famous, he worked with other lyricists. And the one that comes to mind is Bob Hilliard, because, among other things, Tower of Strength, Gene McDaniels, and Any Day Now, Chuck Jackson, that's Bacharach and Hilliard. All right, so 888-876-5593. And Eduardo says, I was talking, you didn't hear me. All right, well, I do now, I hope. Eduardo, are you there? I hear nothing. Why do I? Oh, I see why.
I heard the click.
There you are. Now I found you. You're on a whole other bank of calls. I'm not sure why. All right, good deal.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
What do you know?
So I don't want to get too excited, but as far as I know, it's going to be this for the patient transport at HCA Brandon. And this would be from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. because they do 12-hour shifts.
Okay.
And orientation will be May 11th. They said April 27th was too early, so they said they get me in like May 11th for the orientation.
Okay.
So those are some of the details. But, you know, I wanted to...
This is exciting.
I get more excited when I'm actually, like, in the building and, you know, doing orientation and, you know... You know, kind of moving forward with the position. So, but those are some of the details so far.
Wow, this is great news. This is really good. Congratulations.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, it would have been great to work in Tampa, but you know, you have to go to Brandon. But you know, I mean, I got a car, so I know how to get around.
Right.
So I know how to get there.
Right, and it's not like you're going to have to go through a blizzard.
No. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's 7th Street in Ybor City, and then the other one is, I think it's pronounced Adamo.
Okay.
But it's like Brandon 60, I think.
Okay.
So those would be the two roads that because I'm not going to use the Selman Expressway. I don't like that.
Okay.
So I'll just like sticking to the road, so.
Good enough for me.
Yeah, so we'll. You know, I got to talk again to the. They said they're going to call me and because another thing, I got to take a CPR.
Good.
Class.
That'll be excellent, and that's a skill that will be wonderful to have.
I actually got a little pocket size CPR guide.
Uh huh.
And I've been looking at it. So.
Yeah,
I'm going to keep looking at it just to get familiar with that kind of stuff.
That's a marketable skill. No, that's great. Any job that can give you more skills when you go to another job, that's terrific.
Yeah.
Good.
So, yeah, hopefully I'll have more details. I'll call back tomorrow. What's your time tomorrow?
Yeah, no, I think between now and Labor Day, it is from 10 to 1 Central. I don't think we have any more interruptions.
Okay. Okay, I'll definitely call in tomorrow.
Sounds good. I'll look forward to
it. Okay,
thank you,
Riley. Thanks. Yep.
Okay, bye. That's great news. Totally great news. I'm delighted to hear that about Eduardo. Yeah. All right, Chris in Greenwood, what's going on? Welcome back to WGN Radio.
Hey, Raleigh, how's it going?
All right, how about yourself, Chris?
It's going great.
Good.
Yeah, I just called to say that one of my TV stations is going to be celebrating 70 years on the air next week.
Okay, what are they doing for the celebration?
I'm not sure, but the day I just saw like they did like the old logos and
yeah,
doing 70 years of TV7.
Okay.
And it, yeah, I hope they do something big because you know they owned by Nexstar.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So that should be big. So yeah, they'll probably do 70 years of weather coverage and 70 years of news events and all that. I think that's great. And did they do a documentary? Because I had heard they were going to.
A documentary of
yeah,
what?
Of their, FDA? Of their 70 years.
What are they going to do a documentary at?
I think, I'm pretty sure that they actually had this on the air. I'm talking out of school, no doubt, but I'm pretty sure that they had a documentary about their history. So, I don't know. But yeah, you should probably be able to find that. I mean, I should probably be able to find them, but I'm not looking right now. But I'm not near a computer. But if you are, look it up.
Yeah, because, you know, it was the 70s originally supposed to be in Columbia.
Yeah.
But it didn't happen.
Right.
Yeah, because, you know, they were going to allocate the VHF channels.
Right.
And Walter Brown, that owned the station, he was upset about them being in Columbia, so he moved it to Spartanburg in his own city.
All right.
Yeah, and they signed on, and, you know, there are two TV stations that protested them seven to get signed on and didn't want them on the air.
That's usually the way.
It was Channel 23, WGBL in Greenville, and WAIM Channel 40.
Yeah. Well, this is
And, you know, when 7 went on, 23 went off the air for good.
Yeah, well,
because it was a Dumont station.
Well, not only that. I mean, let's face it, UHFs have been tough. From day one, tough. Now, obviously, it's different now. But back then, a lot of televisions didn't have UHF. You know, it wasn't mandated at first. And then even when they did, it was hard to pick up. And the grocery store was giving away the loop antennas and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, you don't want to be a U, and of course it was even more expensive. But yeah, SPA Spartanburg's own, and but I heard they were doing a documentary. Now I'll have to try and find it.
Yeah, because I grew up watching that station. I remember it used to be Eyewitness News, and
right, of course,
and Jane Robolo was there. She's at YFF now.
Okay.
And Jack Roper was the weatherman, and he was well known around there.
Yeah.
And I remember the programs they had. You remember The Current Affair?
Oh, of course. That was syndicated, absolutely.
Yeah. So they used to air that.
I just pulled a computer out, and here's thank you for being part of our 70-year history. There's all sorts of things that they're doing for this.
So, okay, yeah. And the other programs they had that syndicated is they used to show reruns of Mama's Family, Golden Girls, Designing Women, and Empty Nest and Cosby Show.
Right, but the big thing, of course, is going to be highlighting their regional, local, you know, coverage. So anybody can carry a syndicated show or a network show, but it's going to be the news broadcasts and all that probably is going to be the deal. Fred Cunningham, you know, all that.
Oh, yeah, he was our sportscaster, and now he's the morning news anchor.
Right, and so there'll be a lot about him, you can bet.
And what about Tom Crabtree, because he was there for a long time.
Right, not anymore, but yes, absolutely.
And what about Annette Estes?
Okay, so, yeah, I think Tom retired, God, it's now a decade ago, I think.
He retired in 2018.
Okay, 8 years. I knew it had been a while because, yeah, they did a big thing about his retirement. So,
And it was a sad retirement.
Well, good for him, though. I mean, you know, it's a long career.
Yeah, I remember Pamela Graham and Pete Yanny, which he's the still sportscaster there.
Right. So
and you know, Lisa Gibbons used to work there too a long time ago before she became big.
Yeah, but yeah, Pamela Graham, didn't she become Pamela Graham Anderson? And I think Pamela Graham and Associates.
Yeah, and yeah. I think she left. I think because of the whooping cough she had.
Oh,
well, okay. That's long story short.
That's 20 years ago.
Yeah, and you know, Amy Wood used to be Amy Marsh, and she's still at the station.
Okay.
She did a lot for that station.
Yeah. So, yeah, I remember it's been about 20 years when they fired her, and they did fire her. There were all sorts of... I'm out of time. Call me tomorrow night. Talk to you later. The show is over.
I'll call you tomorrow night.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, the show is over. We're already in the news. I'm talking to myself again. So 21 hours from now, we will do it all again. We thank Adam for keeping us on the air and keeping the station in line, yeah, when I can't. And John for screening your calls. And above all, I thank you for calling. It's what makes the show a pleasure to do. And I did all that for the stream. And yes, I'll get you 2020 news. I forgot about that last night, but I'll get you that tonight. Coming up in a minute on not on WGN Radio, but on my stream anyway.
Car Slosh, plus Shrieking Toms and Hiding Shotgun. I'm Grant Marshall, 2020 news, real stories, real fun. Tequila Surprise, clueless, sloppy, and touchless car wash. Some seriously senseless suds up schmo decides early morn's the time to get his ride rinsed, Ohio cops say. But boy named Spew crashes his SUV in the car wash and passes out. Rescue squad races there and finds foaming at the mouth, has a bottle of tequila and gun on the front seat, along with a caged dog in the trunk, the popo purport. Old fool's a real pistol even when he isn't loaded. Rowdy with a chance of meatheads. Talk about small government. Town council meetings in Toms River, New Jersey are something out of the Jerry Springer show. Mayor Shelbourne calls his council members clowns and lunatics. One councilman fired back, calling the mayor a despicable sociopath. Another labeling him a big piece of beep. There's so much Tom's foolery at council meetings, one official calls it the laughingstock of New Jersey. Ripley's, agree it or not, driver disarmed and deemed dangerous. Somehow things went sideways when a guy in the passenger seat got shot and killed. The driver, a quadruple amputee who happens to be a cornhole league champ, is now charged with the unhinged shooting. People in the back seat bailed when the limbless beanbag wheelman asked them to help him dump the body, cops claim. Hit the road whack was finally hunted down and restrained, if not cuffed. And that's what's happening. I'm Grant Marshall, 2020 News.